Professor Avi Loeb is the former head astronomer for the Astronomical Department at Harvard University, and in 2017 he became interested in what astronomers regard as the first genuine interstellar object observed to have entered into our solar system. He's written many articles, a book, and more recently he's co-written a paper that speculates that some of the UFOs that are being sighted around the world maybe from an extraterrestrial mothership.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here is Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, thank you, Professor Loeb, for appearing on Exopolitics Today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd like to begin with Oumuamua because it was such an extraordinary object that astronomers observed, and it was something that was shaped like a kind of like cigar, a very long object. You describe it as being a flat football field-sized object, and its behavior was strange that led to you, when you looked at the data, coming up with a very radical hypothesis. So why don't you just explain to my viewers exactly what happened?
Yeah, so this was the first object discovered by astronomers from outside the solar system, the size of a football field indeed. It was identified when it passed close to Earth, within a sixth of the Earth-Sun separation, and was classified, flagged as a near-Earth object by a telescope in Hawaii, whose purpose was to find near-Earth objects. And what was strange about this object was that it was moving too fast to be bound to the sun. So it came from outside the solar system, the first one identified ever. And this survey of the sky only occurred over the past decade. We couldn't detect objects as big as a football field from the reflection of sunlight within the Earth-Sun separation before that. So that's why it opened a new window. I was surprised by this because a decade earlier, I forecasted that this telescope should not see anything from outside the solar system because we estimated the abundance of such rocks that we find in the solar system that may have been kicked out to interstellar space. And we found that it shouldn't see anything by a factor of 100 to 100 million. And then this object was discovered. So that was intriguing. But as this object was tumbling every 8 hours, the amount of sunlight reflected from it changed by a factor of 10. It was clear that it has a very extreme shape. And the best fit to the variation of sunlight was that of a flat object. Moreover, it came from a very special frame of reference, the so-called local standard of rest, which is the rest frame of the Milky Way galaxy near the sun. So why would an object that comes from another star be at rest in that frame? The stars are buzzing by at tens of kilometers per second. Only one in 500 was so much at rest as this object was. And so then as time went on, the object, in addition to its extreme shape, which was most likely flat at the 90% confidence, it exhibited an excess push away from the sun. And in fact, there was another paper even today that confirmed the original finding, that there was some mysterious force pushing it that declined inversely with distance squared from the sun. And there was no evaporation of this object, no dust or gas around it that could give it the rocket effect. And the Spitzer Space Telescope looked very deeply, couldn't find any traces. It was definitely not a comet of the type that we're familiar with. It was also not an asteroid of the type that we're familiar with because it was pushed away from the sun. So what was it? Astronomers were not clear about it. I said, well, maybe it's a very thin membrane that is being pushed by reflecting sunlight. And the nature doesn't make such things. So very recently, just a couple of months ago, I published a paper suggesting maybe it was a piece from a broken Dyson sphere. This is a sort of a mega structure that advanced civilizations may build around the star to harvest the energy of the star. And, you know, after a while, these things break up either because of asteroid impacts or because the star evolves, becomes hotter, and then pushes away that kind of a megastructure. So at any event, we don't know what it was, but I suggested it's artificial in origin. And amazingly, three years later, there was another object like it that was discovered by the same telescope in Hawaii in September 2020. It was given the name 2020 SO, and it exhibited an excess push away from the sun by reflecting sunlight, no cometary tail. And then a few weeks later, the astronomers realized it's actually a rocket booster that NASA launched in 1966. So we know that it had thin walls. That's why it was pushed by reflecting sunlight. And it was made of stainless steel. That's why it didn't exhibit any rocket effect or any cometary tail. So we know that 2020 SO was artificial because we made it. The question is, who made Oumuamua? And since then, I should say, I discovered, together with my student Amir Siraj, two other interstellar objects that arrived or were detected before Oumuamua, one in January 2014 and the other one in March 2017. And they were meteors, roughly a meter in size, that collided with Earth and then exploded in the lower atmosphere of the Earth, like meteors do. But the two of them were the toughest among 273 space rocks in the catalog that the US government compiled of meteors. And the question is, why would the first interstellar meteors have material strength that is at least 10 times bigger than even iron meteorites? And in order to find out, we have an expedition planned to retrieve those fragments left over from the explosion of the first meteor over the Pacific Ocean. And we want to figure out whether it was some unusual rock that originated from an environment very different than the solar system, because apparently it was much tougher than even iron, or perhaps it was made of some artificial alloy, like stainless steel. Maybe it was a spacecraft. So altogether, what I'm saying is, over the past decade, scientists were able to discover for the first time the first objects, big objects, that came from outside the solar system. And three out of the four are weird. And so we should figure out what they are.
Well, one of the interesting things about Oumuamua, and interestingly, I was actually living on the Big Island when it was discovered, right, very, very close to the Keck Observatory, you know, and the term Oumuamua means advance or scout. And so that's very suggestive. It's like, well, why did astronomers think it was something that was in advance or a scout for something else? I mean, conspiracy theorists would say, well, you know, is this an advanced craft or a fleet? Or what exactly, why did they come up with that name?
Well, the name was about it being the first object from interstellar space. So a scout in the sense that it's the first one that we noticed. But actually, the email, I saw the email message of the discoverers, and they said it looks really weird. So everyone expected it to be just like a rock from the solar system that we are familiar with. It's sort of like going to your backyard. You are used to seeing the rocks. You know, in the case of the solar system, our backyard, we're used to seeing asteroids or comets. And then suddenly you see something different. Doesn't look like a comet. At first it was called a comet. Then it was realized, no, it's not a comet of the type that we're familiar with. And then people say, oh, well, maybe it's an asteroid. But then it doesn't look like an asteroid. It has a flat shape with a very extreme geometry, and it's being pushed away from the sun. That's not what asteroids exhibit. And it's sort of like finding a tennis ball among the rocks that came from your neighbor. Basically delivers a message that not everything is rocks in your backyard. And, you know, that was a difficult pill for the astronomy community to swallow. And I did not feel attached to rocks. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, if there is no cometary tail, it's not a comet. But a colleague of mine just half a year ago, wrote a review paper about Oumuamua, and he wrote an email to me saying, I just finished a review about the comet Oumuamua. And I told him, what do you mean by the comet Oumuamua? How can you call it a comet in a review paper? I said, we all know that it was not a comet. And my colleague said, well, I have this theory that when we looked at it, it didn't have a cometary tail, but when we didn't look at it, it had a cometary tail. And I said, well, you know, that's just like going to the zoo and looking at an elephant and arguing that it is a zebra, but it shows its stripes when we look away. How can that be the view of the mainstream? That makes no sense. So I feel sometimes like the child, the kid in Hans Christian Andersen's folktale, who said that the emperor has no clothes. And in this case, Oumuamua is the emperor and the clothes are the cometary tail. It's not a comet. And everyone around me say, no, it's actually a comet, but the cometary tail is invisible. And there was actually a Nature paper just a couple of weeks ago talking about an invisible cometary tail. And we showed that the paper had a mistake in terms of calculating the surface temperature. We wrote a paper a day later about it. But people are so eager to make it normal, to make it just a water iceberg, even though it didn't look like a typical comet. And it got to the point that we wrote this paper with my colleague showing that the Nature paper has a mistake, you know, by a factor of a million. They missed a term in the energy equation. And when I pointed this out to reporters who just mentioned the Nature paper a day earlier, they said, we don't want to add anything to our report because it will confuse our readers if we now say something is wrong with the Nature paper. And I ask myself, you know, when we look at politics, we often complain that politicians do not attend to evidence, do not use rational thinking. Yet, even in the context of science, you find mainstream journalists, science reporters, and as well as practitioners of science, just trying to call an elephant a zebra.
One of the people that you have interviewed or you've been working with in the past was Professor Stephen Hawking. And in 2010, he made a really interesting comment concerning the SETI project, putting out radio transmissions, looking for signs of extraterrestrial life. And Professor Hawking thought that this was a dangerous thing to do because hostile extraterrestrials might respond, that he thought that extraterrestrials would be more advanced and that would be very similar to the conquistadores when they came to the New World and conquered the Americas. But very recently, in April of this year, April 10, you wrote a paper where you believe that extraterrestrials offer benefits and are not an existential threat. So why did you write that paper?
That's right. Stephen Hawking visited my home for the Passover Seder, actually, in April 2016. And that was a year and a half before Oumuamua was discovered. I was not that much into the search for extraterrestrial technological objects near Earth at the time. And so I didn't really confront him. But after the past 7 years when I was involved in research along these lines, I realized that I disagree with him because for a variety of reasons. First of all, you know, we have our science and technology just for the past century or so. Quantum mechanics was discovered exactly a century ago, and all of our gadgets and electronics and internet and everything is based on what we learn about quantum mechanics over the past century. But most of the stars formed billions of years before the sun. The sun is a late bloomer, so to speak, and therefore, if there were civilizations that developed technologies and science near other stars, they did it billions of years before us. And so they had not just one century, but maybe millennia or millions of years or even billions of years of science and technology development. So they are likely much more advanced than we are. It's very unlikely that they are at the same phase of our development. And therefore, you know, we would appear to them just like ants appear, you know, in the cracks of a pavement to a biker passing by. I mean, they do not pose a threat. In fact, most bikers do not even pay attention to the ants, and because they have some other objective for their trip, their journey. And so on the other hand, for us, it will be a great opportunity to learn about our technological future, because we are currently, for example, developing GPT-5, and the GPT-4 already has 100 trillion connections, only a factor of 6 shy of the number of synapses in the human brain. So we're getting to the point where AI systems will be even more complex than the human brain, and therefore, you know, we might use them as astronauts in space. We can send them and they will learn from experience, and they will be more able to cope with the hazardous conditions of space. We can harden them, the electronics, so that they survive the cosmic rays over there, and they will have patience to travel for millions of years across in between stars. And so if we can imagine sending AI astronauts, most likely that's what we will see from other civilizations that are more advanced than we are. And we can learn from their technologies. Just imagine finding iPhone 100, you know, and pressing some buttons to figure out things that we've never imagined. It may look like a miracle to us. And in fact, I do think that, you know, a very advanced scientific civilization is a good approximation to God, what religious texts talked about, because it could probably produce life and in the laboratory, and may even be able to produce baby universes in the laboratory, you know, if they understand how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity.
One of the people who started to do work on categorizing extraterrestrial civilizations was Dr. Nikolai Kardashev, who put out a paper in the early 1960s. And his scale in terms of different extraterrestrial civilizations in terms of energy consumption, that would be a measurement of their level of civilizational development, has been used and quoted ever since. Professor Michio Kaku, who I'm sure you know, has popularized that idea. So, you know, when we're looking at this idea that Stephen Hawking put out, that some extraterrestrials may be hostile because of their advancement, and of course your thesis that, you know, level of advancement probably diminishes with the age of a civilization, how useful is this typology? As we go further down this typology, type 1, 2, 3, 4 extraterrestrial civilizations, can we expect type 3, type 4 being more friendly, and type 1 or type 2 maybe being more aggressive?
No, I mean, these categories are based on the amount of energy being harvested by the civilization. So, you know, we at best currently are trying to harvest the sunlight that is impinging on the surface of Earth. And of course, one can imagine a civilization that goes beyond that and uses a Dyson sphere to harvest the energy output of its star. And then you can go even beyond that and imagine using all the energy output from all the stars in the galaxy. But the way I categorize civilizations is differently. I think, you know, the simplest civilization is just adapting to nature, the way nature is, in terms of resources. We were in that phase. And then the next phase would be to use tools to reshape nature and the environment. And that's what we are doing since the Industrial Revolution. But of course, the final phase, the most advanced phase, is to recreate nature. So in a way, we are starting to do that with AI, trying to recreate sentience. You know, we have our first alien baby that was just made, just created, just born in our technological belly. And AI systems will become more and more similar to humans or better than humans on many tasks. And of course, there is a much higher level, not just recreating intelligence, but also recreating the entire universe in principle. You know, if we ever understand how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity, we might engineer that knowledge and try to make a baby universe in the laboratory. And maybe our universe was created that way by someone in a lab with a white coat. The other reason I'm not too worried about an encounter is because I believe in the fittest surviving in interstellar space. By the way, we shouldn't worry about microbes the way that the indigenous tribes, suffered medical disasters as a result of those viruses, the bacteria that were brought by the European visitors, just because the European visitors were biological. I don't think that we are likely to encounter biological creatures. We are most likely to encounter technological gadgets, and they will not bring disease to Earth. And moreover, in terms of the fittest surviving, I believe that the peace-seeking civilizations are more likely to survive because the others, the more aggressive ones, they suffer in conflicts and may get eliminated. They will not live very long. So the ones that thrive, the ones that reach great distances, are most likely those that are not aggressive. That would be my sort of optimistic view on all of this. And I should mention an anecdote. You know, we are investing every year $2 trillion in military budgets worldwide. And just imagine if our civilization decided to listen to John Lennon's words. Imagine all the people living in peace. And if we were to accept those words and use the surplus of $2 trillion a year for the scientific mission of sending crafts to interstellar space, we could send a CubeSat, a probe to every star in the Milky Way galaxy, tens of billions of them, by the end of this century. That much money per year can allow us within this century to send a probe towards every star. And I say, you know, if we can do that, someone else may have done that in the past billions of years. And it takes less than half a billion years to traverse the Milky Way galaxy, the disk of stars, with chemical propulsion. So the one that we are using right now. So there was plenty of time for them to arrive to us. And, you know, in the past 70 years, the SETI community was just searching for radio signals. That's a very primitive technology. Also, radio signals are, you know, they move at the speed of light. If you're, it's just like waiting for a phone call. If nobody is calling you at the time that you're waiting, then you will not hear anything. Whereas if you were to check your backyard for objects or your mailbox for any packages, those can accumulate over time. You don't need the sender to be alive when you're finding them. And in fact, the gravity of the Milky Way galaxy traps those packages. Any chemical rocket moves at a speed that is 10 times slower than the escape speed from the Milky Way galaxy. So all these packages sent over the past billions of years by technological civilizations that may have predated us are still around. And we can look for them.
I know you have created the Galileo Project out of Harvard University. So the website states the goal of the Galileo Project is to bring the search for extraterrestrial technological signatures of extraterrestrial technological civilizations from accidental or anecdotal observations and legends to the mainstream of transparent, validated, and systemic scientific research. So exactly what signatures?
Yeah, so first I should explain that I wrote a book about Oumuamua called Extraterrestrial. I have a new book coming out in August 2023 that is called The Interstellar. And after my book Extraterrestrial came out, it became a bestseller. It had 28 editions, three of them in Spanish. After it came out, I had about 2,500 interviews over the past couple of years. And a lot of people came to my home to visit me. And among them, some multi-billionaires that decided to donate to my research account at Harvard University. And that allowed me to establish, to found together with Frank Laukien, one of them, CEO of Bruker, to establish the Galileo project. And the idea is simple, that it's about time now for a scientific research project to search for technological objects that may have been manufactured by extraterrestrial civilizations near Earth. I mean, we know that we sent 5 probes out of the solar system. That's Voyager 1, Voyager 2, Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11, and New Horizons, and they're making their way out of the solar system in 50 years, over the past half a century. That's what we did. But, you know, if we have more time, we will send many more in the future, and other civilizations may have done that already. So to me, it makes complete sense, rather than argue about the question whether there are objects near Earth, to actually look for them. That's what the Galileo Project is doing in 3 different directions. One is to date the next Oumuamua, find another object like it, and this time around get much better data, because we have the Webb telescope and it's 1,000,000 miles away from Earth. So if we look from a telescope on Earth and the Webb telescope, we can pinpoint the trajectory of such an object in 3 dimensions very precisely and infer whether it has propulsion. In addition, there will be the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile within a year that could identify many more objects like Oumuamua. So that's one branch of the Galileo project, considering the next Oumuamua, dating the next Oumuamua, and we have a dating app, the Vera Rubin Observatory, for that. A second branch has to do with interstellar meteors of the type that I mentioned before, and we are going on an expedition to figure out whether it was artificial in origin, just because it was tougher than all previous meteors that originated in the solar system, and that's the first one from interstellar space. So why should it be so unusual? And hopefully this summer 2023, we will know what it was made of and whether it was an artificial alloy. So that's the second branch of the Galileo project. And the third one has to do with unidentified aerial phenomena that the US government talks about. The Director of National Intelligence that delivered 2 reports to the US Congress. There is a new office, AERO, led by Sean Kirkpatrick. What we did within the Galileo project is assemble the first observatory dedicated to monitoring the entire sky 24/7 in the infrared, in the optical, in the radio, and in audio. And the data that we are getting about objects in the sky is fed to artificial intelligence software, where we are trying to classify the objects we see. And all we need to do is decide whether we see a natural object like a bird or a bug, or we see a human-made object like a balloon of the type that the US government shut down, or maybe a drone or an airplane. And the key question is whether there is anything else. And that's what we're trying to find out by our suite of instruments. And I should say that there was never an astronomical observatory suitable for the job, because astronomers are looking far away in a small field of view at distant objects. If something flies overhead, they ignore it. So we had to assemble a new type of observatory that never existed before, with off-the-shelf components. And the sky is not classified. The only reason the government classifies their data is because it was collected by classified instruments, classified sensors, and they don't want adversaries to be aware of the US government capabilities in that regard. So the way I see it is the Galileo project is complementing government, because government is focused on national security threats. And for me as a scientist, it's boring. If we find anything that says made in China, I don't care much about it. I'll be glad to deliver all that data to DC, Washington, because anything human made is not particularly exciting to me. Of course, it's the day job of people in government to figure out those things. And if they shoot down balloons, that's a blessing as far as I'm concerned, because they reduce the clutter in the sky and I have less noise to worry about. I'm just focused on the third category, other. Is there anything other? There is even a funder of an observatory of the galaxy. So we are making copies of the first observatory that is on Harvard University property. And so we have two copies in the making right now. And one of them is funded by a donor who said that she is interested in birds very much. And so we will deliver an album of all the birds flying overhead. And because again, I don't care much about birds. And so what we care about is, even if one of all the objects is of outside of this Earth from an extraterrestrial origin, that would be worth the entire endeavor. You know, that it's possible that almost all of the objects are from this Earth, and I would not care about them. So that is the third branch of the Galileo project, and we're currently collecting more data than was ever collected on unidentified aerial phenomena in the past, because we have a dedicated scientific observatory that is looking at the sky 24/7. It's not anecdotal. It's not someone pulling an iPhone and looking at the sky at a given instant. There are a lot of reports, but the data that exists out there is not trustworthy. It's not of scientific quality. So we are trying to make it rigorous and careful and analyze the data not by the human eye, but with artificial intelligence.
Yes, I think that's a very important issue, is the scientific rigor that is applied to observations of UFOs. And I think that third branch is a critical one, certainly one that I'm interested in. And I know the Galileo Project website distinguishes between accidental or anecdotal observations and systemic scientific research. But you know, is that a clean distinction? I mean, to me, I mean, these things can get very easily blurred. You know, when we're looking at some of the data accumulated over the last 70 years concerning alleged UFO crashes, I mean, there's a book that came out called Magic Eyes Only that's about 10 years old now. And it presented data on 74 UFO crashes around the world dating from the late 1800s. So there's an abundance of data. Some of it, as you say, is anecdotal. Some of it concerns government witnesses. Some of it are images. Some of it are kind of like technical signatures. So, I mean, when we're trying to distinguish between a purely scientific enterprise, systemic research versus dental or anecdotal, is there such a clear dividing line, or is it really blurred? And I wonder whether a book like this presents something that would be of scientific interest.
Well, these are all intriguing reports, and they motivate my interest in the subject, but they are not scientific quality data. And I can explain that very simply. Consider the Soccer World Cup in Qatar. Okay? There were lots of people in the audience. They had a lot of cell phones. They were all taking pictures of what happens in the field. And then there was an event. The question is, should we give a penalty or not? What did FIFA do? They didn't go to the spectators and ask them for their cell phone cameras to figure out what really happened and whether a penalty should be awarded. They didn't go to the players and ask them, do you think there was a penalty here or not? What they did is use cameras that were fully under control, looking at the field with high resolution and letting the referee look at the video and decide. That's the difference between scientific evidence and casual anecdotal evidence. And the worst type of evidence is human testimonies, because we all know that when there is a car accident and a number of people are involved, each of them gives a different report. And how is it possible, given the fact that it was the same event? Well, it has to do with human psychology. It has to do with wishful thinking, without having a fully coherent sort of introspective view of what's going on. And instruments are not like that. If you have full control over them and they're well calibrated, you have a much better idea about what really happened. So I'm not saying the eyewitnesses are lying or they didn't really see something unusual. I'm saying it's intriguing what they're saying. Okay, therefore, I want to get high quality data, but I cannot write a scientific paper in physics based on what people tell me. That is not the scientific method. The scientific method is relying on instruments that are well understood, not just the instruments that you find on the street. These are instruments that you calibrate, you understand their response to things that you know. Just to give you an example, suppose you want to figure out how luminous something is. Well, you put a light bulb in front of it and you know that how many watts are emitted by the light bulb, you know the distance, and then you calibrate your instrument this way. That's called calibration. But if you just see a bright source of light and you say, I think it was really bright, that's not really the scientific. Or if Ukrainian astronomers say, oh, we see dark objects that are, we believe they are at 10 kilometers distance based on how dark they are relative to the sky, which is pretty much what they did. They didn't have triangulation. And they say, well, these objects move at 15 kilometers per second, more than the escape speed from the Earth. And they look completely dark. And when I saw that, I said, well, come on. If they move that fast, we know that objects moving that fast through the atmosphere should produce a fireball. Now, I say, if you don't have good measurements of distance, you can't argue that they are at that distance moving at that speed, because they could be 10 times closer to you. And they could be artillery shells over Ukraine, okay? So really the burden of proof, when someone claims there is new physics, you can't just rely on crappy data. What you need to do is get exquisite data, such that you know for sure the distance because you did triangulation and you are 100% sure that you know how to how far they were and then measure their speed and so forth. Only then you can argue for new physics or something that is beyond what we understand.
Jump in there? Because, yeah. You know, your example of Qatar using technical photographic means of being able to adjudicate various decisions and how that is now like the cutting edge. I mean, the issue, I mean, what that shows is that for more than a century, the judgments of the umpires were accurate enough so that such a system wasn't needed, that the soccer profession grew and people, there was a consensus that this was, that the judges were fair, that they were accurate, that their observations were fairly accurate enough for the field to burgeon and to grow. And so, you know, this makes me kind of like raise the perspective that, you know, what you have been describing is very much a kind of bias from many astronomers or many of those in the physical sciences. I mean, I was trained as a political scientist. So in the social sciences, we rely on human testimony. You know, we rely on people's observations and judgments of what's happening around them. And, you know, we use various tools and methodologies to work out exactly what is more accurate. And maybe in a sense, you know, what you're arguing is like bringing in scientific instruments to help adjudicate, you know, what is a penalty, what isn't a penalty, what is offside, what isn't offside, whereas what I'm advocating is that human judgment and observation powers are accurate enough that for more than a century, people can make the right calls. And I think when it comes to UFOs...
It's clearly not accurate enough in politics, because you see people on the two extremes claiming the other side makes no sense whatsoever and using violence against each other, meaning that one of them must be wrong if one of them is right. Okay, so you cannot argue that what humans are able to judge is reliable, because you have in politics opposite views using violence against each other. So if one is right, the other is wrong. And how can you judge? How can you decide? You see a lot of people being put in jail and then DNA testing shows that they are innocent. I would never rely on a human being in figuring out the truth about the universe. Okay, we have a lot of examples throughout human history where humans made mistakes over and over again. And it started at a time when they said that the Earth, humans are at the center of the universe. That sounded so reasonable to people for 1,000 years. I'm not talking about you for 5 minutes thinking this is right. I'm talking about the entire of humanity for 1,000 years claiming that we are at the center of the universe. And if you were to ask everyone, they would say, of course, Look at the sun. It moves around the earth all the time. Of course. And you would say, of course, human judgment says that. And I can look at the sky and I see the sun moving around the earth. And you would say, for of course, that is the right thing. And we should put Galileo in house arrest because he dares to say, look through my telescope, and you would see data from an instrument that violates your conviction. Okay? And you would say, I don't care about instruments. I know since the days of Aristotle, for 1,000 years, that we are at the center of the world, and I will put Galileo in house arrest just because he wants me to look through his telescope and use instruments to figure out the truth, okay? And that ended up being wrong conclusively. How do we know that? Because we sent spacecraft that look at the Earth and the Sun from a distance. And the last one, Orion, shows the Earth as a blue marble moving around the Sun. And yet, you, Michael Sala, if you lived more than 400 years ago, you would argue conclusively based on all your friends and all your testimonies and all eyewitnesses and all philosophers prior to you, that the sun moves around the earth. That's what you would argue. That's what you would put on social media. And you would jump up and down when Galileo was shut down because he was looking through his telescope. So here I say that what humans argue is irrelevant in science. What we should use is data. Data obtained by instruments that are well calibrated and look at the sky, because we were proven wrong. Now, not only in the context of the Earth being at the center of the world, and I'm repeating, for 1,000 years, people were sure about that. Not only in that case, but now we know that the Earth-Sun system is not unique. In fact, somewhere between 3% to 100% of all the Sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly at the same separation, meaning that life could have formed on those planets. And nothing is special about our environment. In fact, what we see in our backyard is common. This is not a matter of humans arguing among themselves and deciding that that's the case. It's a matter of looking through telescopes and seeing it in the sky, seeing it through the instruments, through images taken by the instruments, not by the people. The instruments give us this data. So now we know the Earth-Sun system is not unique. So what do we have left? What we have left is humans arguing that we are the only intelligence that ever existed since the Big Bang. So when you ask me to rely on human judgment, what most humans in academia, everywhere you go, you ask astronomers, they might tell you, I don't know. I think actually it's quite possible that we are the only intelligent species that ever existed. So if I wanted to rely on the convention in academia, in science, I would say there is nothing to look for. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Just like we are at the center of the universe, the only thing that we can hang to right now is to say we are the only intelligent species ever existed since the Big Bang. Albert Einstein was the smartest scientist who ever lived in the last 13.8 billion years. That would be the convention these days that you want me to surrender to, that you want me to listen to, because people say that. And I say, I don't care about what people say. I want to figure it out. And if I see a technological object in my vicinity that is coming through images that my telescopes are detecting, that's no different than Galileo realizing the Earth moves around the sun, because I'm using instruments to figure out the truth. I'm willing to surrender to whatever data my instruments obtain, not to have a prejudice. That's exactly the point of doing science, to be curious without prejudice, not to listen to what people, because there is a lot of chatter always on social media among people, and most of it is wrong.
Well, you know, let me just put it to you in this way. I mean, and the Galileo Project is interested in extraterrestrial technological signatures. Now, you know, whether it's a scientific pursuit or whether it's something that's appropriate to the social studies or political science endeavor, you're looking at human observations and judgments. If we'd like to take a third approach, which is the intelligence approach, you know, you're an intelligence analyst in, you know, whatever intelligence organization around the world, and your job is to search for extraterrestrial technological signatures. You're going to look for the scientific data, which is you have an abundance of that. But as an intelligence analyst, you would also be responsible for looking at, well, what are the human sources of intelligence on this? You know, have there been reports of these extraterrestrial technological signatures? Have people come across crashed craft? Would we look at that? So, you know, ultimately this comes down to the question, when we're looking at UFOs, this third branch that the Galileo approach is interested in, you know, should we limit ourselves to a purely scientific perspective, as you've outlined, or should we take, say, the approach of the intelligence community, which is looking at all of the sources of the data?
Well, let me offer you a third possibility. Why don't you go and listen to people that are high on drugs or put goggles on their head? Okay, these people witness a virtual reality and they will tell you it's as real as the reality we live in because in their goggles, they see something. Why don't you listen to them? Why don't you go on a person that is high on recreational drugs and tells you, I really feel something about the quantum universe and there is something moving faster than light. You know, all these things are human made. I don't care about what humans make up. That's not really the task that I have as a scientist. My task is to figure out the reality that we live in, not the reality that you can see through goggles or through recreational drugs or through hallucinations or wishful thinking or whatever, you know, that you see a lot in politics, you see a lot in other disciplines. That's not really the reality that I'm trying to figure out. I'm trying to figure out the reality that we all share, out of which we build our gadgets, out of which we build our technologies, which serves us on a daily basis. You know, the cell phone that we are all using is not a matter of human opinion. I mean, it was developed as a result of understanding nature, the reality that we share, you know, at a quantum level. And that would not be possible if it was up to humans and not instruments detecting that reality, because nobody expected quantum mechanics to be there. Nobody. Michelson, a very famous physicist, at the end of the 19th century said, you know, physics is almost over. All we need to do now is figure out the constants of nature to the fifth decimal point. And he said that at the end of the 19th century. Then 5 years later, Albert Einstein realized, oh, actually, you know, space and time are, you know, are completely different than we thought before. They're not absolute. And then 15 years later, he realized that the curvature of space and time is gravity. And then 25 years after Michelson's speech in Chicago, the University of Chicago, quantum mechanics was discovered. And we realized that, in fact, what we think of reality is not really the reality that we live in. And all of these revelations came about after humans were sure that they understand, you know, not just humans, physicists. So how did it come about? It came about because of data that was obtained that convinced us that indeed we don't fully understand. And right now, there are lots of holes in our understanding. For example, we don't know what most of the matter in the universe is. We call it dark matter. You know, and then we don't know what happened before the Big Bang, what happens inside a black hole. There are lots of things we don't know, but the way to figure them out is not to ask people. The way to figure them out is by consulting nature. And the same is true about one of the fundamental questions is that we have, which is, are we alone? Okay. And to answer this question, we should not ask people. We should look through our instruments and see if there is any evidence for any neighbor that we have. And by the way, this would give us a meaning to our life, because Steven Weinberg, who won the Nobel Prize in physics, in his book, the first 3 minutes at the end of the book, he said, the more comprehensible the universe is, the more pointless it looks. And I say, well, it looks pointless if you focus on particles and radiation that have no life, like stars, galaxies. But once we find a partner, it will give a meaning to our existence.
If you have time for one more question, I would love to ask you about this paper that you just wrote recently, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, that some UFOs may be probes from an alien mothership. So could you just explain why that hypothesis was put forth?
Well, this is discussed also in my book, Extraterrestrial. It's a possibility because when you have a big craft passing through the solar system, it makes a lot of sense to spread the small probes that will visit planets and many locations on a given planet. This was just mentioned in the introduction of the paper. The paper focused on using physics, what we understand about physics, to constrain unidentified aerial phenomena. That was the main purpose, and it resulted from a visit that Sean Kirkpatrick made to my home. He was in the area, and you know, altogether, as I said, I do see the Galileo project as complementary to the work of government.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Loeb, for coming on to ExoPolitics today and sharing your research and insights into this whole UFO extraterrestrial phenomenon.
Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to ExoPolitics today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.